Good afternoon. You're listening to KFSK News for Wednesday, March 19th. I'm Olivia Rose. Alaska experts on energy, housing, and infrastructure say billions of dollars are in limbo from President Donald Trump's funding freezes, and that uncertainty is affecting local communities. The Trump administration paused funding for several major federal programs back in January. The freeze has interrupted projects in Alaska like heat pump distribution and building infrastructure that would protect communities from storm surge and tsunami. The disruption was discussed by eight representatives from Alaska-based organizations during a joint virtual press conference last week. They said that in total, more than $5 billion is at risk from the bipartisan infrastructure law and over $720 million from the Inflation Reduction Act. But those numbers are a moving target, given that some programs have been frozen and unfrozen irregularly. Andy Romanoff is the executive director of a Southeast-based organization, Alaska Heat Smart.
Alaskans are losing from uncertainty. Homeowners are potentially losing. Workers are losing. Contractors are losing. And we hope that recent thawing of funds will somehow survive.
One of Alaska Heat Smart's projects aims to install heat pumps in dozens of communities and lower energy costs. But around $40 million of federal funding for that project has been frozen and reopened several times, which disadvantages everyone, but especially low-income families, he says. Tashina Duddle works at Deerstone Consulting, which supports tribal energy infrastructure projects across Alaska. She says many of the grants that are currently frozen for Alaska are slated to fund projects that prevent shore erosion and stabilize villages against permafrost melt, flooding, and extreme weather. One example is a program through the Bureau of Indian Affairs that supports tribally led climate adaptation. The program has allocated $72 million in funding for nearly 40 Alaskan tribal projects. It is now on pause.
Without this funding, villages will be lost to erosion, infrastructure will collapse under worsening climate conditions, communities will have to relocate without a plan, without resources, and without dignity.
Duddle adds that projects in question create crucial economic opportunities in rural communities. That includes construction jobs. She says that right now, agencies are unsure what projects will be able to move forward and what spending will be reimbursed. And that means a meaningful construction season this summer is unlikely. Some of the funding needed to study long-term solutions to glacial outburst flooding in Juneau has arrived. Last week, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers received $4.75 million to begin technical studies that will inform a later fleshed-out feasibility study of potential solutions to annual flooding in Mendenhall Valley. Denise Koch, Juneau's Director of Engineering and Public Works, wrote in an email to flood-affected residents that this is, quote, a fantastic first step, but that the city must still secure millions more for the full feasibility study. The funding came from the Federal American Relief Act passed in December and will be dispersed over the next 4 years. The money will create a technical report, but Nate Rumsey, the city's engineering and public works deputy director, says it's not clear what that means.
That's something that we need to hash out with the Army Corps still, but we're hopeful that it is essentially a jump start into what a more traditional feasibility study or general investigation would be.
Rumsey says the future feasibility study will look at various ideas to protect Valley residents, such as building a dam or permanent levee, expanding Mendenhall Lake's capacity, siphoning water out of Suicide Basin, or even blowing up the glacier or surrounding mountains.
We're just too early in the process to be able to give any definitive ideas about what the likely solutions are, but I think those are all at least feasible.
Army Corps staff involved in the project were at a conference yesterday and could not be reached for comment. As the city and Army Corps consider long-term plans, the short-term plan to install temporary flood barriers along Mendenhall River is underway. The Alaska House Resources Committee met on Friday to hear testimony on a resolution recognizing the long-standing partnership between Canada and the United States. It also acknowledges Canada's sovereignty. Two of Skagway's elected officials participated and outlined how a trade war with Canada could, and perhaps already is, harming the Upper Lynn Canal. KHNS reporter Melinda Mudson has more.
Skagway Vice Mayor Deb Potter had just 2 minutes to articulate her support for House Joint Resolution 11. She participated in the hearing telephonically.
One of our local restaurants, one of the few of them that is able to stay open year-round, received some calls from folks in Whitehorse expressing that because of actions that are being taken in Washington, D.C., they will be boycotting and no longer supporting our locally owned restaurant that's owned by a fantastic year-round family with a couple young kids.
Potter says that the Assembly has received letters expressing a similar sentiment. Assemblymember Orion Hansen, who is also a builder, made the trek to Juneau to testify in person.
We need our Canadian neighbors. We need each other.
He shared numbers to illustrate how intertwined Skagway's economy is with Canada.
Last year, Skagway welcomed 1.2 million cruise ship tourists. Nearly half of those tourists originated their cruise in Vancouver. At least half of the cruise ship tourists that come to Skagway take a shore excursion that goes to Canada. Since the gold rush, millions and millions of tons of Canadian ore have traveled from the mines of the Yukon through Skagway and onto the world marketplace. In 2024, 24 million gallons of fuel was transported from Skagway's ore dock to Whitehorse.
Hansen, who often gets building supplies from Whitehorse, says that Skagway families rely on Whitehorse dentists, vets, and grocery stores due to the remote location of his hometown.
If a trade war ensues between the United States and Canada, the cost of living in Skagway will go up. It'll spiral up very fast.
State Representative Chuck Kopp is a Republican from Anchorage and a co-sponsor of the resolution.
What we are saying is that we recognize that there is a lot on the line here besides a dollar value in a partnership that goes back thousands of years, and that the mutual trust and support that Alaska and Canada specifically have with each other is unparalleled in modern times with a shared 1,100-mile border.
Anchorage Republican Julie Colomb is a member of the House Resources Committee. She asked Kopp about the purpose of the tariffs.
The context in which these tariffs are being put forward, though, is in relation to border security and drugs. Do you have any concerns about maybe Canada's not doing all it needs to do to stop drugs coming through their border, or is that not a concern for you?
I don't have any such concern. So the U.S. Border Patrol itself reports that less than 1% of all fentanyl comes across the Canadian border.
Mm-hmm. Colomb says she supports the partnership between the two countries, but has a problem with Canada's leadership.
I want to support that partnership, but this is basically running against our own leadership and supporting the leadership of Canada. That's not something I like to do.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Just in response, I would say this isn't about the leadership of two countries. This is about the people of two countries and standing together.
The Premier of Yukon, Ranj Pillay, also spoke telephonically. He introduced his location distinctly.
In Canada, a country that is not and will never be the 51st state.
Pillay praised the relationship between his territory and Governor Mike Dunleavy's administration, calling it the strongest he can remember.
And we are pleased to be working with his administration on important issues like salmon conservation, justice for missing and murdered Indigenous women, as well as building up northern infrastructure, trade, and tourism.
Besides trade, Alaska has agreements with Canada for help with search and rescue and fire incidents near the borders. The resolution's next stop as a full House vote. It's not yet clear when it might come up for debate. A similar resolution is awaiting a floor vote in the Senate. In Skagway, I'm Melinda Munson.
Ketchikan's school district superintendent is resigning less than a week after the school board president stepped down. Michael Robbins announced on Monday that he will be resigning at the end of the school year. Robbins has been Ketchikan's head school administrator for a little over 2 years. Previously, he was the principal of a small school in the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta. School board member Catherine Totsida told the Ketchikan Borough Assembly on Monday night that the board hopes to begin interviewing potential replacements as early as next month. Robbins has recently been overseeing a process to restructure the island's elementary schools to meet the district's more than $1.6 million budget deficit. The plan was approved by the school board last month. It's been met with significant uproar in the community. Tatsuda told the Borough Assembly that she was concerned about moving forward with the process in light of Robbins' resignation.
Especially with Superintendent Robbins leaving and the shakeup in district leadership, I personally am concerned about making such a massive change that's been so controversial to district staff and then also the community and the impact on families.
Robbins announced his resignation in a 4-sentence email to district teachers and staff. He said he will be resigning on June 30th and looks forward to, quote, supporting a smooth transition in the months ahead. Limits on Alaska's commercial fisheries were established in the early 1970s to ensure the industry could sustain itself. But researchers and Sea Alaska shareholders say that's backfired in rural native villages, where many family-run boats have stopped fishing for good. And as KTOO's Alex Solomon reports, they're calling for change.
A half century ago, Angoon's Harbor was packed with small, family-operated boats that caught fish on hook and line, called trolling, or with a big net called a purse seine. Salmon and halibut fed mouths and bank accounts. Peter Duncan, mayor of Angoon, remembers those days. But it's not the same anymore. He says that fisheries regulations have caused
devastating changes. You just don't find a troller in our harbors anymore.
He says that's made people more dependent on government help, like food stamps. Duncan grew up fishing on his father's seiner in the small Tlingit village on Admiralty Island. He graduated to his own troll boat and commercially fished until the early 1990s, when he says he couldn't make a living that way anymore. Folks weren't catching enough salmon to make money, so permits became more valuable to sell. Many of those permits left the island, and with them went the means for the village to sustain itself.
It's sad to know that at one time, we used to be, you know, a strong fishing fleet that took pride in going up and going fishing.
Duncan's story isn't unique. This reality has unfolded in most rural villages throughout the Gulf of Alaska, as first reported by the Northern Journal. In part, it's an unintended consequence of a law that took effect in 1975 called the Limited Entry Act, which allowed the state to issue a set number of permits for each fishery. The goal was to address a sustainability problem. At the time, salmon populations were plummeting while commercial fishermen multiplied. The idea was simple: cap the number of people fishing, and there will be enough to go around. But that's not what happened in native villages. Courtney Carruthers, an environmental anthropologist at the University of Alaska, Fairbanks, led a study of more than 3,000 Sea Alaska shareholders and descendants about the community impacts of fisheries limitation policies. She found that Sea Alaska villages owned half as many fishing vessels in 2019 than they owned in 1978, and commercial salmon permits had dwindled by more than a third since 1975.
This is not good public policy if our communities in the Gulf of Alaska, surrounded by the ocean with, you know, thousands of years of fishing knowledge and history, within one generation are cut out. I mean, this is an absolute crisis.
Joe Nelson is interim president of the Sea Alaska Corporation, representing Tlingit, Haida, and Tsimshian interests in Southeast Alaska. His airy corner office in downtown Juneau looks out over Gastineau Channel. Clouds trundle into the snowy peaks of Douglas Island. Glossy magazine copies of Carruthers' study are spread out on a table. The report points to a loss of fishing access as one of the main reasons people leave their rural villages.
It's all been going one way, and that's migration out of most of the fleet and most of the permits.
That out-migration, he says, leads to schools and other services closing down. Those who stay behind are aging out of the industry without enough young people to pick it up, he says.
So the whole economy just shrinks. It's much bigger than a single fisherman that decides not to show up anymore.
Nelson says that the state needs to tweak the limited entry system so that native communities can fish commercially without going bankrupt. When limited entry started, the price to fish for salmon skyrocketed from hundreds of dollars to thousands.
So today, a seine permit in Southeast Alaska is worth about $140,000, and a drift permit is worth about $44,000.
Those numbers vary, depending on how well a fishery is doing. Johnson says that while the Limited Entry Act helped make Alaska's fisheries more sustainable, it created this new problem. Now, the commission is talking internally about potential solutions.
Transfer a permit to another rural resident in the same area that you live in.
But any changes would have to come through the state legislature. Sea Alaska is not advocating for specific policy changes just yet. Nelson says there must be open public discussions that look at the slew of ideas. But first, he wants state officials to recognize that there is a problem. In Juneau, I'm Alex Solomon.
For KFSK, I'm Olivia Rose.